Hello, I'm Dr. Andrew Finney, and this is the Nurse Researcher Podcast. And this is one of our bonus episodes. Like all episodes, there will be an episode summary after the interview, so be sure to listen right to the end, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Hello, and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast, a very special episode today. Live episode from the RCN conference at the University of Northumberland, and we have an audience with us. So I'm going to say good morning to the audience, and you can say good morning back. It's not a pantomime, but I'm going to say good morning.
Good morning.
Proof that we have an audience, awesome. Joe. Proof that we have an audience, and we haven't staged it at all. So we're delighted to have you as a guest. I think it's fair to say I've asked several times, and we've never been able to get a date together.
No.
You've had a sore throat. I seem to have woken up with a sore throat this morning, so it wasn't meant to happen to some extent. But to have you here is amazing. To have you at the conference, you know, you're somebody that everybody looks up to in nursing and is always the guest of honour, really. So to have you on the podcast is amazing.
Oh, thank you. It's a real honour to be here, genuinely.
You don't get away with any of the questions. So we have to take you back.
Yes.
It's all about you. Tell us about how you became a nurse and why you became a nurse.
Okay. Thank you. Well, it's funny, I've listened to a few of the podcasts. I did expect any researcher to do. And I'm not someone who always knew that I wanted to be a nurse. In fact, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I left school. For various personal circumstances, higher education wasn't even an option. So, but what I did have was a really early exposure to healthcare, and that was through my mum's illness. So my mum, Josie, she was very young. She got breast cancer and she died when I was 14 and she was 37. And that was a real kind of pivotal moment, I think, into showing me what good healthcare looks like. But many years ago, what really difficult cancer care looked like. So, you know, we'd go to the hospital, a hospital where I've since worked. And so I could kind of see what that was. But the general practitioner in particular was amazing. So that gave me a bit of an insight. But life circumstances then changed, and so doing any further education wasn't an option for me, and I wasn't sure. So I followed pretty much what my sister did and went into administration. I actually always fancied working for the co-op. That was one of the things I really wanted to do. I was fascinated by the Green Shield stamps. So for those in the audience that are probably a lot younger than me, it was a precursor to your store cards. So, you know, I was really kind of open to that. But the pivotal moment for me wasn't actually in nursing, it was an ambition to be a midwife, and that was the phenomenal midwifery care I got as part of the birth of my first son, Jonathan. First of all, she had a cape, which really impressed me, and I thought, I like those, I wouldn't mind one of those. But she was brilliant, she really cared for me, I was very young, she stayed after her shift, and even some of her colleagues stayed, and they just really helped me. I thought, that's what I want to do, but I didn't have enough qualifications at that time. I was somebody at school who was attaining well, but then didn't achieve what I could have done. So I had three children in 4 years. And then with the great help of my husband together, we kind of both went on the journey of my career. So anything I've achieved has been really for my children and in partnership with my husband. So I started my training not long after the birth of my third child. Did some additional training. I think he calls it the DC test, and then did my GCSE maths. We talked about that last night. And so ventured in, thought I would want to do a degree in nursing first. I thought I'll do nursing because I wasn't aware of direct entry midwifery. So I started, I applied at Nottingham and they wouldn't let me in as the degree, which is ironic now as I've got an honorary professorship there. But I do remind them. But then I got offered a degree course elsewhere, but couldn't afford the travel. So I went and did the diploma. And do you know, it was the best thing. I think one thing I've learned is sometimes we don't understand the journey that we've got to go on, but it was brilliant because of the people I met. I did the diploma as a mature student, and then we were with direct entry midwives at the start, and then we joined with Ellie and other cohorts in the other side. I went and did a midwifery placement, and I realised then it wasn't for me. Just the environment wasn't, I think, where I was going to thrive.
Yeah.
So I found my home in a wonderful team in gastroenterology and hepatology. So that's where I've kind of focused my career. So whilst nursing hadn't always been even a thought or an option, it's been the most wonderful and continues to be the most wonderful career, really, for me.
So without putting that to a year, what age were you when you started, when you did that diploma?
26.
26.
I was just the youngest in the mature group.
And would I be right in saying, and I don't want to go down the political minefield of this, that you perhaps couldn't have done it without a bursary?
Absolutely not. No, that kept us going.
Which we all think back to, don't we? I don't think I'd be a nurse without a bursary.
No. But it certainly made it a deal breaker for us as a family.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So a diploma from where you start feels like a huge academic achievement, doesn't it?
Yes.
You get there and you think you've topped out. Because I know I got the exact experience. I can't believe I've got a diploma, you know. And but did you feel academically that was the right level for you? Was it comfortable to do it? Was there an early sense that you would push on academically? Were you just trying to get that qualification?
I think at first I wasn't sure what I could achieve. You know, it's always been that, am I clever enough to do this? I remember even walking through the university doors, it's something as someone Nottingham born and bred, it was something that was distant to me. So that was exciting. I did well. I worked hard. And there was many times I thought, I don't know if I'm going to pass this module. But as then I started getting the good grades, of course, being the person I am, I have got to get the next good grade and the next one. So, but I knew, having wanted to do the degree before, that's really, I could see that's where the profession was going and that's where I needed to go. I had on qualification a brilliant ward leader, Andy Mearcons, who's still a nurse specialist. She was doing her master's. She encouraged me to look at the evidence right from qualifying, and I could see others doing the same. So I thought, right, I'll pay for myself to do a top-up degree.
Yeah.
And through that, met someone who was an inspiring course leader, Lynn McLaughlin, who's, I've had champions all along the way. Got my bachelor's degree, got a first in that.
Yeah.
Thought, that's it, I'm never going to do any more. And then went on to be a specialist in as a nurse practitioner in gastroscopy. I run a gastroscopy service. And then specialised in inflammatory bowel disease, which is what I suppose is my real passion, long-term conditions and IBD. But worked within a very research-active culture in Nottingham.
Yeah.
Didn't know it was. It just happened to be like that, and had great champions, both from nursing and particularly from medicine. Professor Chris Hawkey was a really great champion for me, because you just do research, don't you? It's nothing unusual for them.
And you were just talking about younger audience members. I suppose the people that you talk about, the champions isn't quite a modern term, isn't it? But they were your influences, weren't they?
Absolutely.
And we've all had them in our careers, the people that you aspire to be, wish you could be them role models. And you've named two already, haven't you? We're early in your journey. I was probably like you, and I think all of us, and all when you listen to all of the interviews, if you listen to everybody's got a bit of imposter syndrome as a nurse. And there's a sense of, you know, did you mean me? You know, there's a knock on the door, I didn't mean you. You know, if you don't feel like it should be you. So you've topped out there with a first bachelor degree. You must now recognise, I'm good at this.
I understood the academic process, I think. Once it dropped, you know, what is critical analysis was always, what does it look like? I kind of got that. But I think it's the passion for the learning. Then it got me really curious. You went that next stage, and then you realise what you don't know. So I wasn't sure whether a master's degree was something I could do. There was a professional doctorate. But I did a master's module as part of my gastrointestinal training. We were doing upper GI endoscopy, and I did well at that. So I thought, okay, what is it that I can do? I looked at options, and at Nottingham there was a master's in research methods, well before there was any funding that I had. But it was a phenomenal course, and it still is.
Yeah.
So I went and did that part-time whilst working as a nurse specialist. And working with the consultant team and the registrars, what came across was that the patients that I was working with, it was really clear there were some who were really impacted by their condition. But that didn't always tarry with the histology and with what we would class as severity of condition. And it fascinated me to understand more What was it like, first of all, to live with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, a condition which, conditions which are often not predictable? But how do people get that sense of personal control? What does that mean? And so did some exploratory work, first of all, in my master's, and then applied with a lot of support to get an ESRC-funded PhD studentship. I was adamant if I was going to do a PhD, I wouldn't do it part-time while I was working. Mm. It was too much for me, too much for my family. You're basically doing two things at one time. So I had to step back, though, give up my job, be a student for 3 years, used it as a job, but there was very little option to continue at that time. I mean, I know it's still difficult, but no option at all to continue in the trust.
So essentially there, you're almost being told you can't be a clinical academic, you've got to go off and do something academic. There's no fine line between the two, it's black and white. You've got to go backwards almost.
I don't think there was even a discussion about clinical academics at that time. You know, we're talking 2005. It just wasn't even there. It was just you go as a student. Perhaps there was, I just wasn't even aware of it. I didn't really have any career planning whatsoever. But I knew that this was an opportunity. I was going to take it. I could see that it would help develop me, would help me explore the PhD and do something different.
And a question that you'd set, so was it a proposal you'd designed so you could live with the PhD? It was your work. And I always think it must be difficult to take a PhD off the shelf, which sometimes you have to do to get to do a PhD. There's a number listed with a fund and you can choose one, but actually you don't just live with it. It sits with you all the way through. You wake up in the night thinking, I should have done that. I haven't done that yet. You know, guilty of eating Christmas dinner for too long because you've got something to read. And people don't get that until they've done a PhD to some extent. So it's your question, it's your PhD. What are your colleagues thinking? So you've been somebody that they've looked up to, you've been working in this unit and you've been working in gastroenterology, and they've then seen you step away from it. And it's very early in the PhDs for nursing. Were you a bit alienated? Did you do it? Was it a lonely journey, or were you able to sort of work amongst a sort of collective of people doing PhDs?
I think I wouldn't say alienated at all. I think people, you know, just got on with their job and realised I was doing something different. And I did still do some work in the endoscopy unit at weekends, not doing lists, but supporting lists. But it was quite lonely. PhDs are lonely. But I was part of a cohort then. So the university had a number of ESRC studentships. Mine was competitive because my theme wasn't within theirs. So I had to go competitively. But I was surrounded by then a group of people, one of whom was here this week. So that was better. But clinically, I have to say, I discovered Facebook halfway through my PhD at that time. B, I spent probably the last 6 months trying to find a job. So that was on my mind significantly. And so through a passion of mine, as you've probably seen from my career, to try and limit that from anybody else to have to do what I did.
And I sit here knowing that one of my PhD students is in the audience thinking, right, what happens at the end of the PhD? So it hasn't changed, has it? We're trying to create pathways. It's far better than it was. And we're trying to work towards that next stage, aren't we? So what was it for you? You've got your PhD now and you're jobless. Is that what's happened?
Well, I managed to go back to a nurse practitioner in endoscopy.
Perfect.
But there was no scope for doing research. So I wanted a clinical academic career. I could see that my consultant colleagues had that, but the environment in the organisation, I even wrote my own kind of adapted a job description, didn't land at all. So there was an opening at another organisation, not as research intensive, but a very visionary chief nurse who wanted someone to develop capacity and capability for nurses, midwives and AHPs. So I applied, thought, right, let's, you know, go along a next journey. I knew I couldn't stay where I was. And that was the first corporate role I had, so I could cut my teeth. First time I ever chaired a meeting, went to a board meeting. You know, you don't realise those things until you're there. And that was great. And I had, that was just as the NIHR was coming in and there was the Masters in Research Methods. So I had opportunity to work closely back with the University of Nottingham on that too. And so I was there about 2 years, and then a similar role came up at Nottingham University Hospitals. I applied for that and then was brought back. And that's really where I've then spent the last, since my most recent job, 10, 11 years try to build capacity and capability for nurses and midwives, and of course AHPs. So that's my journey to date, really.
But I'm not going to let you get that far in advance. So my thought is, before we come on to where you are now and before we come on to, you know, the role that you do, you've stepped back into practice there, and you used the term clinical academic perhaps before we even used it as a term, really. So it puts you in that sort of almost trailblazing role, doesn't it? Of, right, I've got to go back with a PhD, be a nurse again, but sort of be an academic as well. Mm. Did postdoc opportunities come? Did you do research after your PhD instantly?
I did, actually. And I've managed to try and keep involvement in research wherever I can. It's more difficult most recently. But so with Professor Chris Hawkey, we applied to Crohn's and Colitis UK and did some more work in relation to stem cell treatment. So there's autologous stem cell treatment for people with Crohn's disease. And I wanted to understand about how they make a decision to take part in that, you know, in terms of that was something that was coming from the data and consenting around that. So he went with me. He walked all the way across London with me. He answered most of the questions, and we secured what was £50,000 then to do what is the DECIDE study. It was the first time I'd ever kind of run a study on my own. But I'll always remember him being there, and they asked, you know, why should we fund you?
Yeah.
And he was just obviously so confident in that. It was a really great ally and support to me. And then I've been involved in other research, probably as a team member, secured money in relation to upper GI cancer as well. But it's always now treading this line of what is it that I bring to the team? I can't necessarily be bringing in the HTA grants and whatever, but I don't beat myself up so much about not being all things to all people, but I have, you know, wondered what is, I'm not ref returnable, and but I do this, and so now I'm more comfortable in my skin, I think.
Yeah. And that's to do with job specification. Yeah. I suspect yours doesn't say you need to be ref returnable.
No, it doesn't.
So that's how that works, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
But I think with your journey, it's probably one that people can resonate with now, isn't it, still? The fact that it's that pressure to be, even now, a nurse in a unit or a ward or in the community, to be doing a PhD, you're an outlier still, aren't you, to some extent? So what gave you your passion to want to support others with research when you could have just shone in your own career and now you've been more of a giver than a taker with research?
Well, I think you get so much more than you ever give. My joy, genuinely, if I see, and I'm with colleagues today, that I might have had some part in their success, it's so much more rewarding, or equally as rewarding as anything that you get. You do get success. It's just through a different way. And I have been brought into studies, joined in publications, and all of those things. People always give back, so you don't miss out, really. But I'm absolutely convinced that, you know, we all need to be doing what is important in terms of changing the landscape then.
Yeah.
I don't want to complete my career and be still where I was in 2009, still trying to navigate it. And I know it's still difficult.
Yeah.
But we had a lot limited funding then and all of it. So I think the landscape is changing with all of us, the group effort that we've got going now.
Yeah, absolutely. What would be your proudest moment as your research career? If you look back on your research career, what are you perhaps most proud of?
Oh, there's a number of things. I think one of the things that really stick out for me is particularly, I suppose, seeing individuals develop. But in terms of my own research, you know, when you present that and you present it to patients, I remember presenting to Crohn's and Colitis UK, and you're always wondering, does it really reflect? This is my real test. The experts are really testing me now. And it absolutely landed. And I even presented the findings as part of some master's training, not knowing that somebody in the audience was living with Crohn's disease. And she came to me at the end and said, you've just described exactly what it is for me, you know, that constant battle, but the negotiation between what I need to be good in life with what I'm willing to accept. So they're the things I'm really proud of. But then just seeing the individuals that you've been part of their journey then starting to transform care.
Yeah.
That's what gets me up in the morning, really.
Yeah. So a lovely tale that your proudest moments about what you've done in patient care.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, on the research journey, whereas most people would probably go, well, when I got my PhD, which I think would have been instantly my thought, when I got my PhD, and you've instantly gone back to that patient care element to it. The question that often people aren't prepared for is, if you could start that PhD, well, not PhD journey, if you could start that research journey again, would you do anything differently knowing what you know now?
I think so. Yeah, you can't change it, can you? But on reflection, there are things that I could have probably done that if it was someone else doing it now, I would have perhaps just taken the courage at times to go and introduce myself to more decision makers in the organisation.
Yeah.
Real Champion was the chief nurse at the time, and I didn't feel able or have someone who could take me through that door. And I think if I had, that might have helped negotiate things a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
I would certainly have published a lot earlier and got people alongside me. I think that's my one thing that I just, the rejection of publication is the one thing that kind of, you know, getting alongside and just tackling that a lot earlier, I would probably have done. They were kind of the most things, but I think it's around building that team around you and not being afraid that people don't respond necessarily, but... Yeah, otherwise I think, you know, these are the things that make us who we are, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I had a conversation with somebody in the audience last night around nursing, and what did we agree on? You are where you are because of who you are, not despite, we said, didn't we? And I think that applies to a lot of nurses. And it's because of who you are is why your journey's been as it is. So flipping that with regards to you and what you would do differently in your, you know, hindsight now, at this conference, I think some of the best research I've seen, the person hasn't had a PhD. It's been a nurse dedicated, passionate in an area and has been able to demonstrate either service improvement or evaluation or some early research, which has been great. And not every nurse will want to do a PhD, but they'll want to be involved in evidence. They'll want to be involved in research. What are your tips now in your current role for anybody at this conference that's come because they're a nurse and it's research?
Well, I just think we should celebrate that for a start. I mean, you will know that, you know, the strategic plan nationally is, it talks about leading, participating and delivering. So there is room for everybody. And it is as important, isn't it, for us to implement the evidence that we've got and to support the culture of research, because then those that want to lead can do so. So, yeah, we need to celebrate that. And but also, it neither is it just about nurses delivering trials. And I think that's also important to recognise. And we do need to make space for PhDs in nursing and celebrate that too. So there's room for everybody. And absolutely, that's where it should start. And let's be clear, just because somebody's leading research, they might also be delivering on someone else's trial. So it isn't just this or that, it's that and that. So I think that's brilliant. And the conference, I think, is role modelling that, which is great.
Because there are different research roles for nurses.
Yes, at different times.
And all equally valuable in the setting that you're in. So I introduced you as Joe Cooper, not Dr. Joe Cooper. Apologies for that. I realised as I'd started to talk, and I thought, I can't go back. Can't go back now. Nothing I can do. So Dr. Joanne Cooper, tell us what your role is now and what's been the key component of your role at NHS England.
Well, it's a really great role, and I work in partnership with Professor Alison Richardson, who is just amazing to work with. So we both work in a Deputy Director of Nursing Research role. We sit in a team that is led by one of the Deputy Chief Nurses of the country and sit alongside colleagues, peers that also lead for different areas of practice, so mental health nursing, community nursing leadership, learning disabilities and safeguarding. And I think that's really exciting, because what we're all talking about is trying to hardwire research. And so to be alongside people practically and physically when they're talking about strategy, we now, research is there, and we have a really, always had great leaders at NHS England, and particularly now we're able to push that with a new chief nurse as well, who's equally supportive of research. So it's the policy setting direction, particularly working through the regional teams, but then having the opportunity to work with phenomenal regional and local leaders to start the ripple effect of all of the things that I experienced, all of the things that we've seen and that we need, of course, Ruth Endicott, Professor Ruth Endicott and her team, it's just a really great time, I think, and convinced to be in this space, but needs all of us to deliver on it.
And it feels like the last few years, if I think about the CNO strategy, which we're sort of still working towards that. The NIHR with the drive towards underrepresented disciplines, Council of Deans, the Karen Group, the RCN, there's a real pull in the same direction at the same time, isn't there?
Yeah.
Is it working? Do you think we're achieving?
I do. I, of course, this is a culture change as well. It's a professional culture change. But we can see the influence in multiple stakeholders at different directions. So the work that Jane and Karen are leading is the four nations are also working with HEIs and, you know, having the conversations we can't have.
Yeah.
Equally, the RCN and the NIHR. But we also work not just in nursing, we work across the whole of NHS England.
Yeah.
And that is a real focal point. Research is a focal point nationally too. So I think it is. We just need all of us to step in and do what we do best.
Yeah.
Grow the future leaders, secure the funding, you know, and really focus on the areas that are important for our population. I think that's what we can do perhaps a bit more focused in terms of our priority areas for research and the quality and perhaps interventional nature of our research, which builds but talks about complex interventions, but it's not. We're often seen as qualitative researchers, aren't we? I think it's about how we utilise all of the methods and methodologies as nurse researchers.
That always fascinates me because nurses do always sort of say they favour qualitative research. I think it's extremely difficult and complex. I much prefer
it's
numbers.
Yeah.
I find it ever so difficult.
Yeah.
You know, and with my own students and their qualitative work, I think that looks fantastic. I'm glad you've done it. You know, it seems so complex. So it's not the easy option, is it, to do that? And you lean towards what answers your question, you lean towards the research that's right for you. So my final question for you, before I go to the audience, and this isn't about others, this is about you. So what ambitions do you have now in your current role?
In my current role, I think, well, some real objectives now for us and for me are about how I work really closely with our regional and provider leaders to support them and work and learn from them about what a really great culture in our organisations look like, to support colleagues in the HEIs too. And I think that's the joy of what NHS England can bring to the table, is that level of strategic direction and influencing. We've got chief nurses, many, many of them, that are not just responsible for nursing, midwifery, HPs and so on, but are really interested in their role in research, which possibly, like mine, necessarily isn't, or some may be leading research themselves too, but also how do you make that ripple effect so that your organisation lives out what we need so that we can lead, participate and deliver research as a profession. And it's not unusual. Now, that's going to take some change, but I think that's going to be the step change for me. And also then start to see the results of the £30 million a year investment and the impact of that research, both on the individuals developing as part of it, but the research that comes out of it.
Yeah.
You know, we've got HTA for nursing. We've got, I mean, it's just a wonderful time. So that's what I'd like. 2 to 3 years' time, let's have a look back.
Yeah.
Perhaps you can invite me back and we can think, you know, where has it really landed?
Yeah.
And what's the transformation we've seen? I want British English nursing to be known as the top in the world. And I believe we have it and we can do it. It's just about galvanising it, making it more visible and really getting structures and processes to make it happen.
So if I was to summarise what you said there, it lends itself so much to everything we're hearing about research now. What your vision is the impact of the research.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's what it is. And that's what we will have to reflect on, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I suppose with REF, the Research Excellence Framework, that's what we're judged on as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's nothing further to say than thank you, Dr. Joanne Cooper.
Thank you.
So unique, that we don't get in any other episodes is an option now with a little bit of time left for questions for Joe. What I will say is I'm not editing or cutting any of this. Exactly what I'm saying now will be in the episode. So if you want to say who you are and where you're from, that will be on the podcast episode. If you don't, you don't have to. You can just ask your questions. So don't feel under pressure to do it. Any questions from the audience for Joe? I'll go in the order of which the hands went up.
Was first?
Yeah. Pass his finger first.
Okay, thank you, Joe. I'm Dr. Jane Code, a professor of nursing from the University of Nottingham. That was awesome. Thank you very much from all of us. We were all taken, you know, to your world, so thank you. I was wondering if you thought, you said about leadership and you said about organisational. What do you think as individuals we should start to do as nurses to make these changes? Sometimes I think as nurses we almost apologise for ourselves within our profession, but also externally in that interdisciplinary platform. So have you got any top tips that you think that we ought to start doing as individuals? Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. What a great question. So individually, you know, what we all bring, we're all experts in the field. And I think I perhaps in the past have forgotten that, you know, in terms of what we do with our patients. Our staff nurses are those that they're 2 a.m, making a decision as to what they need to do, whether they need to intervene or not. So I think as individuals, it's really being confident and understanding your specialism, your contribution to research. And so that I think is something that we can start to foster. So the educators in the room start to foster that pride in what, as a registered nurse, you bring, or a midwife, you bring to the table 24 hours a day everywhere in this country is where nurses are. So I think as individuals, if we're educators, if we're those that are supporting them in practice, to help and celebrate that evidence-based practice that we have. As individuals here, as those that are perhaps delivering research or supporting that culture, making an effort to bring it alive within clinical practice and so that people know the great activity for research that's been funded and that's happening, to work with our patient population. And the leaders in the room, I think, you know, it's really about how we knock those blocks down. We break down those barriers in any which way that we can. Operational leaders have a real part to play in it all, in whether people can go on secondments or whether there is a job at the end of the day, being creative with someone might leave and then you create a different position, right up to executives and chief nurses. Because I think all of those things together would be great, but for everybody in the room, myself included, to look at the SORT tool, for example, that was one commitment we could all make, and really think, what in terms of my culture do I think is the maturity for research, and what am I going to do then as an action plan to take it to the next step?
Thanks, Jo. I've really enjoyed listening this morning. And my question is, I'm Michelle Briggs. I'm the Clinical Professor of Nursing at the University of Liverpool, Liverpool University Hospitals. And you've mentioned the Research Excellence Framework a number of times, and we're really clear about what is excellence in academic practice. What's the equivalent in clinical practice, and what does excellence look like academically?
Academic.
So clinical academics, what's the clinical excellence framework? What should that be?
Well, we do have a framework in terms of what that research pillar looks like now. So for anyone who's listening or here today, to look at the multi-professional research capabilities framework, because that's a really good question. And so what does capability and excellence look like right from entry level all the way to consultant level practice? So I think we do have some sort of a framework in identifying what that looks like. I think it is the same thing though, impact. What is the transformation that we will see from people who are leading transforming care clinically? And if we can capture that together, then I think that's a real strength. We did some work together, didn't we, on the apprenticeship, which was a real journey, so we were looking around that. And I think what we came out with was that person who was excellent was someone who was transforming also across a system. So I think it's the strength also is where we look beyond our organisation to the system and the partnerships that we work with. So I think if I had to nail anything, it would be where you can show that transformation, both in terms of the workforce and the public, within your own area, but to the system and the environment that you're working with in your ICB level or whether it's your regional level.
Okay, then Aladeo is behind you, and then we'll have time for one more.
Thank you, Jo. I listen to you with great interest. My name is Aladeo Bufani, clinical academic. Spent some time in Medicare Foundation Trust as a research effectiveness lead, and spent some time in the Bujumbura University as a senior lecturer in mental health nursing. Now, one of the things that you said, you landed in a research hat and culture. You had influencers.
Yes.
One of the things I still struggle with is this idea of nurses. When you look at policies, we need nurses. I would argue that, yes, we're all nurses, but we're different. We're different because as a mental health nurse, I do know that that's an area that it is currently on that sort of, it's not well supported, and we have a strategy that acknowledges that. And I'm just curious to know, if you're having these sort of conversations with chief nurses, for example, and if you are, what's the nature of the conversation you are having to support this group of, you know, underserved? Because nursing, broadly speaking, underrepresented. Within nursing, we also have underrepresented disciplines. Because the potential here is that we're talking about joint contracts, for example. The logistics of that can be very complicated. We talk about job planning. When you have chief nurses, you've gone to nursing because you want to provide care. The landscape has changed. Not many of them would be comfortable in terms of talking research. The question is, how are they advocating for something different, and how are they going to be creative? Because at the heart of that is a solution. When we think about the job descriptions and the ones of sort of job planning, the research pillars, there's a lot of evidence as to how you can do that. But what conversations are we having with the chief nurses to support us to do something different is my question.
No, thank you. And a really good question. So you've hit the nail on the head really there, but about what support also do we give to our executive chief nurses in the research space? You know, you will know that executive nurses have an awful lot on their plate. And so we know, and we're convinced research is important, so how do we support them? And we did some work with the Florence Nightingale Foundation, who explored that very question with a group of executive senior nurses. And you probably won't be surprised, there's a sense of a needing growing of confidence, understanding, like many of us, possibly not socialised into what research is. Research at board level often sits outside of the nursing executive position, often with a medical director. Not everybody has who we've got in this room, people who can help navigate that. So there is work, and that's where my work with the regional chief nurses is also looking to bring together, and there are bringing together of executive chief nurses to help them understand their role. And it isn't necessarily then leading a trial. It's creating the organisation, culture, and overcoming some of their barriers. But what we find is it often isn't the chief nurses that's the challenge alone. They're absolutely supportive. It's also those that are at the operational level where some of the decisions, and say blockers, but people are doing different things, that's their world. So with working, should be out soon, a matron's toolkit, matrons and health and care leaders toolkit. So that's our responsibility, is to try and help people understand what they can do. But there are conversations going, but the workforce bit is really exciting to me because, and I haven't worked it out yet, so anybody who'd like to come on this journey, we have care hours per patient day. We don't have research and innovation hours per patient day in our safer staffing models. How do we start to unpick and explore how we make it beyond job planning, that is a valued and calculated part of our model of staffing? It's beyond my brain, but I so that is a piece in our mind. We're also doing work with some regional chief nurses who've nominated themselves this year to do a piece called Supportive CNOs for Research Do. That's what we're calling at the moment. a guidance document that helps support our executive chief nurses and brings alive case studies and examples of what they can do to support research. Alone they can't do it though, can they? And so there's a lot to do, but we are starting to take that forward. But I can say hand on heart, I've never spoken to a chief nurse who isn't supportive of it. What they need is support to help bring that alive. And some of them have people that are particularly focused on capacity building and will bring them forward. Not everybody does. So our responsibility is to bring that across the system and to level up those that are in more underrepresented areas, or GP practices or primary care areas that don't have any capacity or any support. So watch this space, but thank you. Please be in touch, and perhaps you'd like to contribute to some of that work. That'd be great.
Is it just the role to help you?
Yeah.
One final question.
Hi, Jo. I'm Dr. Ellie Drew from Nottingham University Hospitals. So, Jo, you've been fundamentally inspiring and encouraging me to take my clinical academic career forward. What would you now say to your 26-year-old self, newly qualified nurse, to inspire school and college leavers, those who are student nurses and those who are newly qualified, in terms of how they might start at those early stages to take a clinical academic career forward, if that's what they want?
No, thank you, Ellie. Great question. I would say that I would encourage them to, in any placement, and I know that this work already happens, but in any place, to seek out the evidence, seek out the researchers, find out not just the skills that you're doing, but understand the evidence underpinning what you're doing, to reach out to those in your university or those leading researchers in other universities, what's happening in the research space. There are programs now, aren't there, the Insight program for students newly qualified to give you exposure to research. So I'd encourage me to get prepared to do some of that. I remember seeing an advert for a research nurse on the corridor in the Queen's Medical Centre, and someone said to me, "Oh, that's what you're going to do." And I thought, oh no, I couldn't do that. So even back then, there were signs and ways to try and explore that. But I'd encourage me to really start to engage and be curious and ask and to reach out to those that are already leading it, so that I could see what that journey looks like. Yeah.
Wow. Inspirational, lots of wisdom, some great questions. Let's hope it's recorded. It will be a great episode. All I can do is say, finally, one final thanks to Jo, one final thanks to you as the audience, and thanks for a great episode. Hello and welcome back to the Nurse Researcher podcast with this very special summary episode based on a live interview, a live podcast at the RCN conference this year. And I was delighted that it was Dr. Joanne Cooper. Eleanor, we both know Jo well, don't we? And really enjoyed listening to this one.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I was really fortunate actually to be introduced to Jo throughout my PhD journey, and then also was fortunate as well to work under her leadership as a research lead at NHS England whilst she was head of nursing research. So I was incredibly fortunate to be able to experience that. And I just, having listened to this story, I just felt so inspired all over again. You know, it really was a story of somebody that's faced, you know, significant adversity, losing her mother at such a young age, but never letting that stop her from making choices about her career that were undoubtedly hard, and, you know, sacrificing her career for 3 years while she did her PhD as well. But somebody who I feel is a real visionary, an absolutely incredible role model, and she just speaks from her heart. I was engaged throughout this entire story. Really enjoyed listening to it.
Yeah, well, we've had a bit of a break, haven't we? And we haven't spoken for a while, so this is the first time we've had chance to discuss this really or anything else with the podcast. You've been working hard on that PhD and the time has flown by a little bit since the conference. So I mean, I can say I was probably introduced to Joe via a community of practice that you led, and
Yes.
like you, find a inspirational, find a very supportive and a very natural leader. And I think we both identified that that comes out in the fact that everything that she seems to be pushing for or proud of is the things that she can do for other people.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely Jo. And, she emphasized in this, podcast, how important it was her to have those champions that supported her along the way, crediting some key individuals. And I think that's really important. And I can see why she's so passionate about doing that for other people, because she too's had those individuals, have taken her under her wing. And it's interesting that one of them was a medic. She mentioned Professor Chris Hawkey. And I too was taken under the wing of a medic in developing my clinical academic career. I'm not sure if I know why that is, but I think it makes a point in some way that working with our multidisciplinary colleagues is a good thing. Maybe it's historically the fact that they've had more opportunities as medics, maybe to gain more funding, and it's a bit of a newer venture, maybe. Nurses may feel in terms of developing clinical academic careers, but being taken under the wing of individuals like Joe said, really can help you, I think, to gain confidence and develop self-belief. One of the things I think she mentioned actually was she said, "Am I clever enough to do this?" And I think that probably resonates with a lot of people. I think you do question yourself, don't you? And I don't know if that's more common in nursing, midwifery, allied health professionals, if we do that more. But actually having those individuals that champion you along the way, like Joe as well, really help, to develop and build your confidence.
Yeah, I think we both picked up on that element of her saying that she'd had champions along the way. It's probably the episode quote, I think. I think that's probably the
Yeah.
episode quote because it resonated with us both. But
Yeah.
I don't want to skip over the sort of slightly sad beginning to the
Yeah.
episode. It seems wrong of us to skip over that to some extent. Jo mentioned the passing of her own mum when she was only 14, and it in some way, through the care that her mum received, that it sort of guided her towards thinking she'd want a career as a nurse. And we normally hear a different story, don't we? We normally hear mum's a nurse, or and my mum was a nurse and I did this. So that was quite sad to hear, and really, I'm sort of really glad that Jo felt she could share that in such a forum.
Yeah, I think you're right. She's faced, I mean, I can't imagine at the age of 14 how incredibly hard that must have been. But throughout the story that she tells, it's become almost a story of optimism, the way she's created her career, and obviously very devoted to her family and her husband as well, and all the decisions were based around that too. Yeah, it's incredible how what she's faced and what she's had to navigate from such a young age. And just look at her now. I'm sure her mum would be really proud of her, I'm sure.
And
But yeah.
we hear so much now as well, don't we? And it happens a lot. You hear so much about poor practice or poor care. So the stories of, well, the way her mum was looked after really, really sort of impressed her and made her feel like it's something she'd want to do. And then the care she received, when she was in maternal care, and the sort of thoughts that she might originally want to be a midwife. So it's nice to hear positive stories once in a while that actually they've inspired you.
It is, isn't it? And sometimes, you always feel almost surprised, how positive sometimes people's experiences can be, because there is a lot of negativity, isn't there, about, the care that people do receive, perhaps more so, over the last few years. But yeah, absolutely. She's so positive and such an optimist, I think, how she's tackled the challenges that she's faced.
And I'm not going to let this one pass. The co-op's loss was our gain,
Yeah, well, it's funny. I mean, I know what she meant by store cards, but I didn't know about the little green stamps.
what we can say, if she does listen back to an episode, is that Joe, Eleanor and I are far too young to know what you mean by green shield stamps. We don't know. But I did think that, the thought she could, I'm sure she'd have been the national manager of the co-op by now if she'd have been doing it.
Oh,
And
yeah, for sure.
so
CEO, yeah.
that original inspiration to work in the co-op did make me laugh. But
Yeah.
I think we can pick up a little bit on that sense of role modeling and the things that she's provided for others and the way that she's identified that for herself. And one of the other things that I noticed, and she did point out, that she didn't feel alienated in any way to do this, but she had to take, she had to sort of support her own top-up degree. She had to step away from her role to do a PhD. She was left then thinking, right, what next as a job? I suppose some of that resonates with you as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's the tricky bit. What when she said that she spent the last 6 months of her PhD looking for jobs, that's kind of where I feel like I'm at now as well. But also I think she did highlight the sacrifices that you do make, when you are doing your PhD. She did hers in a 3 year period, which must have been difficult, with three children as well. But she could see what the benefit would be. And I think that's where I thought, you can see how she has got this vision of how everything will be, and she makes it happen. She really does. But yes, it certainly did resonate, because I do think it gets to that point in your PhD journey where you're conscious of the fact that, you've put in all this effort, and you really want to create some impact, not only from your research, but it's like, okay, well, what do I need to do next to develop? And it's kind of trying to piece that all together and find the right fit for things. And she said she wrote a job description, didn't she, that didn't land, and I think it's not being, what I'd take from this is not being fearful of putting yourself out there, and don't worry if, it doesn't land, or if you fail the first time. You've got to keep trying, that perseverance that you develop and that resilience that you develop throughout your PhD journey is really important in other ways as well, I think. But Jo's got an immense amount of resilience anyway, hasn't she?
Absolutely. And I suppose the other thing for me was that sense of, again, the selflessness, really, that even when I tried to say your proudest moment, the proudest moment for you, it was more pride in the fact that the research had made an impact on her patient or patients.
Yeah, presenting her own research. And it was really inspiring as well. It was almost like she sort of slightly had questioned how her research was going to land when she presented it, but it landed really well. But also, I think that was really important to understand, that whatever she'd done during her research to explore those experiences of people with Crohn's disease, she obviously really got to grips with, their lived experience of it. And seeing how that, may transform care is really rewarding, I think. So a great story.
Yeah, sometimes it's not about the impact of the paper or the impact factor of the paper, is it, or the readership. It's that patient voice that's saying, actually, you've just told my story, or that's resonated
Yeah,
with me, or that's
and you've
changed.
understood.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is really rewarding,
So that
because
was really interesting.
I think that is really important. If you're a qualitative researcher as well, I mean, obviously. My research is qualitative too, but I think when you feel like you've understood people, it is a good feeling. They feel like you've gotten to grips with, what is really going on.
So I think well, I hope people enjoy the episode. I hope people liked the additional questions, the sense of an audience. It was a little bit different. It was nice to do on the day. It was a supportive audience. We thank the RCN for allowing us to do that, and the tech guys that helped us up at the university. So it was nice to do it. I was delighted to be able to showcase Joe a little bit in this way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people will enjoy listening to this and feel inspired by Joe's story. So can't wait to see it out
So last episode with you for a bit. We said that last time, but I pulled you back in.
there.
But last episode with you for a bit. This is a bonus episode. I have now done a recording for the new series with Roxanne. So Roxanne Crosby Nwobi will be taking Eleanor's role briefly for 5 episodes, where the next series 3, will be the NIHR senior research leader. And we'll be interviewing people of different disciplines across 2 cohorts. So that will be coming about, I would have thought, late November, early December of
Right.
2024, and we'll work it through from there. So again, another great episode. Hopefully more bonus episodes on the way, and we won't let you off for too long before we drag you back.
for the next series, and the next series after that will probably be the PhD student, so you'll have a real firm story to tell.
Yes, thanks, Andrew.
Maybe that's the first time you come on and actually do the episode rather than the summary.
That'd be great. No worries. Yeah, I'd love to do that and look forward to hearing the next series as well with Roxanne.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I'm sure it will go well. What she did say on the first recording is you were a hard act to follow for the summaries.
Oh, that's very
So
nice of
you'll hear that when you hear that first episode.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I'll look forward to it.
Lovely. Ellen, thanks for your time as ever.
Thanks, Andrew. Take care.
Cheers. Bye bye.